Talk given Saturday, 26th April, 1980. Life, and in this context, by life I'm not confining the word to biological life, but life in its total sense. Life brings each member of any species to birth, and it is life which manifests the ending of that particular member by means of the phenomenon we call death. With respect to us human beings, a living structure grows from the moment of conception within the maternal womb, leaves the womb at parturition, enters a new environment, and is born as a particular, unique being into our everyday world. The mechanism which has made evolution possible is the sexual process. Each parent produces a generative cell called a gamete, and the union of the male and female gametes produces a zygote, which can develop into a new individual. The development of a gamete is the important thing in this process. The gamete, male or female, the development is a process which differs from that which occurs in the production of a non-reproductive cell. The gametes are generative cells. For the gamete involves, the process of the development of the gamete involves the rearrangement, and this is the important point, the rearrangement of the genetic material inherited by the mother and the father from their respective parents. The union of the male and the female gamete produces a new individual, different from the parents, and also from every other individual that ever was or ever will be, for such is the complexity and variability of living matter. Every new life is a new creation with something new to contribute to the future of humanity, and new in possibilities, where the individual himself is concerned, of mental and spiritual development, which are dependent on the physical development of the body plus the influence of the environment. Now, these points must be carefully borne in mind, because if we see this clearly, we shall see that this is not a transference. When a new individual is born, he is not a transference from a pre-existent person. And so this fact of nature is incompatible with any theory of the reincarnation of a permanent, identifiable entity. See, this the scientific knowledge of this process takes into complete account, therefore, of the fact that everything is changing. There is nothing which is permanent and remains as an identifiable entity through time and space in different forms, or, as we might say, enclosed in different bodies through time and space. Our psychical activity of thought and feeling is dependent upon the interaction of parts of the highly complex central nervous system. When the brain is damaged, thought and feeling are extinguished or changed. When we die, the central nervous system, and with it the record of thought and feeling in each lifetime, disintegrate altogether. That is, the psychophysical organism dies completely. This, as you will see, is really in line with the Buddhist analysis of the existential person, the existent being whom you see and touch and know and experience in your everyday life. The psychophysical organism dies completely, and the misconception, I am I, as a permanent, unchanging, identifiable entity, separate forever from all else, disappears absolutely. There is no personal survival whatsoever. But at the same time, as the Buddha also taught, there is no utter annihilation either. Now, everyone finds it very difficult to grasp this. The existent is something which is expressed by the one total reality. If you like, use the word transcendence or God or the primordial creative energy or any term you like, is expressed, that is, pressed out of itself as a particular, finite, limited and mortal manifestation of that which is infinite, immortal and eternal. You see? So, there is no personal survival. The particular, the finite, completely disappears out of manifestation, and all that is associated with the finite. What there is, of course, is the infinite, the eternal and the immortal. This is not, when I use the word eternal here, don't mix it up with the Buddhist teaching regarding eternalism and annihilationism. The term eternalism applies only in the context of considerations of the finite existent. People believe that they have a soul, an entity, as a separate entity existing forever and ever. And that is where the trouble lies, in trying to square that with the fact of what actually takes place and what there is. Now, the finite being then is expressed by the infinite totality. And when the finite being dies, all that is associated with the finite being disappears altogether. There is nothing identifiable left. We might then say, ask, if that is the case, how does karma work out? People get very puzzled about that. But think carefully. Whatsoever one thinks, feels, speaks, and does affects the totality. It's the totality which bears the impress and the consequent change of the influence of the thought, feeling, speech and action of each and every single creature. So that totality is changed. And when totality expresses the new individual, the evolutionary process always produces a new individual with no sense of the I am I of a pre-existence. That is the actual fact. The I am I consciousness emerges after birth. And it completely disappears with death of the existent manifestation. So you will see that the karmic consequence of not only our actions but all our thoughts and feelings and our ideas and so forth and our insights too work out in terms of new individuals who come into being. You see, one of our troubles is that we think of justice on the universal scale as being somewhat similar to our petty little ideas of justice. 20 shillings for a pound note, or if you like, 100 new pence for a pound note. That is not justice on the universal scale at all. It doesn't work that way. That's the whole point. See? We say that if a particular person has thought and done something, then that person must bear the full consequence of it. How? Why? When you think a thought, are you the sole agent of that thought? How many other people have influenced you in giving rise to that thought? How much has circumstance influenced you in giving rise to that thought? And similarly, every single thought, feeling, word and action that comes out of each one of us, in that everything is involved. The total environment is involved in that. We are not exclusive sole agents. And therefore, how are you going to apportion out to an agent and say that you were and you alone were responsible for this, therefore take that as the consequence? It just doesn't happen that way. One has to look at it in the broad way and try and understand it, which implies, of course, the capacity to be able to have the wide vision and at the same time the deep vision, the all-inclusive vision. This is the important point. There is no exclusiveness whatsoever in the entire world process in any one particular situation even, or one particular context or event. The totality is constantly involved in what is manifest through each and every one of the multitudinous expressions of that totality. Then only we will really begin to understand the meaning of karma and be able to appreciate the fact that the word itself is derived from kri, which means to create. And we don't know in our little sphere and with our little understanding what creation in this total sense means and implies. But if we try and approach it this way and let the mind be at rest, which means particularly put aside, and the Buddha also taught this very, very clearly, put aside every preconception, assumption, prejudice, bias, put them right aside and let the fact speak for itself to you. Then you have a true insight, or as it is put in Mahayana, you get a true perception. Otherwise, all our perceptions are just no perceptions. We'll come to that in a few moments. (Clears throat) we might then inquire, how is it then that the misconception of separate entity, I am I, arise, and what is its significance? And its use, its purpose, it has a purpose, a temporal purpose only, and a temporary purpose. What is its significance and use in the life of mankind, not only of the individual man, but of mankind as a whole? Now, with regard to its significance, surely that is pretty obvious. It is that we may be able to develop a true sense of self-responsibility, fairly and squarely on our own shoulders rests so much that happens not only to ourselves but to our whole environment. And this sense of I am I, if we wake up to the deeper meaning which lies at the back of the misconception I am I, what it is trying to tell us, then we shall have a sense, true sense of self-responsibility. There is only one self, the totality itself. When the totality, to use Hindu terminology, Brahman, says, I am, that subjective expression is the Atma. Brahman says, I am, and the I am is the Atma. Brahman is the word, the objective word for this totality. And that is the everlasting self. It is an aseity, that is, it is a self-subsisting, self-existent thing. The Buddha also presents the teachings which lead to the self-existent reality. It's worked out more by the Mahayanic teachers. So when in one's own innermost consciousness, when in one's own innermost consciousness one becomes more and more capable of thrilling to this totality as such, then the nature of this aseity, which is the one and only self, the self-existent, self-replenishing, self-regenerative, self-recreating reality, comes more within our intellectual ken. We have true insight into we begin to have a truer insight, I'll say. When I say a true insight, it means as if that is the finality, but there's no such thing as a finality anywhere. So we begin to get a truer insight into the real nature of things as such. Now, as regards its use, this misconception of I am I, what is its use? It supplies us, through mistakes and suffering, the stimuli which enable us to grow in self-knowledge, because all our conflicts, all our anxieties, fears, troubles, difficulties, and so forth, arise out of the fundamental separateness which we assert when we say, I am I and not you or this or that or the other. We cut ourselves off. We divide ourselves from the universe. But the universe is one whole, manifested as the innumerable many. And when any one of the many says, I am different from, separate from anything at all, then he is asserting something which is not true. And because of that consciousness which animates all his thought and feeling and action, he brings sorrow upon himself and also upon his total environment. So that is one of the uses to which this misconception of I am I can be put. You can't do it deliberately. You gradually begin to see it, and then it flashes into your consciousness, and you get a purer and purer vision of what the actuality is. And when that happens, you grow in self-knowledge in the commoner garden sense of self-knowledge. Not just one's own qualities, abilities, and so forth, and the way one acts and thinks and so forth, but also you get self-knowledge in the very wide, inclusive sense. What I mean is this. We are accustomed to say, I am suffering, I am enjoying, etc., etc. Or, I am foolish, I am doing this thing well, and so on. But instead of saying, I am, you say, this is suffering, this is pleasure, this is so and so. And when one sees it in that way, more and more impersonally, then you are at the same time seeing it more inclusively for all humanity. And when one sees, has real insight in that manner, then one's capacity for helping others grows in the true sense. Otherwise, you know how people rush here, there and everywhere trying to help so and so, help so and so, and all too often succeed in making a bigger mess of things than before. So all that would disappear. You obtain a certain capacity to be perfectly calm and have a tremendous reserve of strength, of mental and spiritual power to be effectively helpful to those who are in trouble. So, in that way, this which starts as a misconception of I am I as a separate entity, the misconception dissolves and one becomes truly established in consciousness of oneness with the totality. It has to be a conscious realization, not merely an intellectual perception. Seeing a thing intellectually is the starting point, but when it has become a true conscious realization within oneself, then it has become a capacity, an actual power which you naturally and spontaneously wield for everyone's benefit. Otherwise, it is pretty impotent. A mere intellectual percept is pretty impotent as such. But it is a starting point. So we must never despise intellect. as so many people try to do. Intellect can be, and all too often is, a stumbling block, true enough. But without that stumbling block, you can't progress. You've got to use that stumbling block. When we were very little children, we tripped over something. If we didn't trip over something and fall down and experience all sorts of sensations, some of which were agreeable and others not, then we wouldn't have learned to stand upright, walk straight, and to run, and so forth. We wouldn't develop that. So all these things have their place in our development. And if we really grow in our understanding that that is how our life as existential beings progresses and teaches us, then we can face life and deal with it in the right way. Not by fighting against, not by trying to overcome this, that or the other, but by being so with it that you really understand it. And in that understanding, when the understanding reaches its culmination, there is the complete dissolution of all illusions and delusions in relation to it. So all these things have their place. Now we might ask the other question, the misconception of I am I, a separate being, arise for us at all shortly after we are born? Well, first and foremost, of course, the little infant does not have a sense of separation of itself from others. But those around, using the words I, you, using the name of the person and all the rest of it, and the names of other people, of other things, gradually calls forth the consciousness of I. Because then when I hear my name being pronounced, I respond to it. Until then, I don't. So the misconception has its origins right in our infancy. Now, as we grow older, the misconception becomes greater and greater through the imperfections and limitations of sense perception and sense experience. We, as we are, as we go about in our everyday life, we think, oh yes, I saw that, I heard that, I know that. this is our wonderful delusion. And in connection with this, there is, of course, that very delightful story of the 10 blind men and the elephant. Let me read it for you. It comes in the amongst the verses of uplift in the Udana, the 6th chapter, the 4th section. There were several of the ascetics in the forest, known as wanderers, who had all sorts of different views. And they were arguing about it all. And the Buddha, who is relating this, says, "Then, O monks, that Raja, the ruler of the place, called to a certain man, saying, come thou, good fellow, go and gather together in one place all the men in Savatthi who were born blind. Very good, sire, replied that man, and in obedience to the Raja, gathered together all the men born blind in Savatthi, and having done so, went to the Raja and said, Sire, all the men born blind are assembled. Then said the Raja, My good man, show the blind men an elephant. It's rather strange as the language stands. How can you show anything to a blind man? Nevertheless, what else could the Raja have said? Very good, sire, said the man, and did as he was told, and said to them, O blind men, such as this is an elephant. And to one man he presented the head of the elephant, to another its ear, to another a tusk, to another the trunk, then the foot, back, tail, and tuft of the tail, saying to each one that that was the elephant. Now, monks, the Buddha goes on, that man, having thus presented the elephant to the blind men, came to the Raja and said, Sire, the elephant has been presented to the blind men. Do what you will. Do what is your will. Thereupon, monks, that Raja went up to the blind men and said to each, Well, blind man, have you seen the elephant? Yes, sire. Then tell me, blind men, what sort of thing is an elephant? Thereupon, those who had been presented with the head answered, Sire, an elephant is like a pot. And those who had observed an ear only replied, An elephant is like a winnowing basket. Those who had been presented with a tusk said it was a plowshare. Those who knew only the trunk said it was a plow. They said the body was a granary, the foot a pillar, the back a mortar, the tail a pestle, the tuft of the tail just a besom. Then they began to quarrel, shouting, Yes, it is. No, it is not. An elephant is not that. Yes, it is like that. And so on, till they came to fisticuffs over the matter. Then, monks, that Raja was delighted with the scene. Just so, O monks, the Buddha goes on, are these wanderers holding other views, blind, unseeing, knowing not the profitable, knowing not the unprofitable. They know not Dhamma, the truth. They know not what is not Dhamma. In their ignorance of these things, they are by nature quarrelsome, wrangling, and disputatious, each maintaining it is thus and thus. Now that's a very, very instructive story, indeed. See, these men, blind men, had four senses which they could use. And therefore, their perception of things and their understanding of the nature of things was completely conditioned by the fact of the use of only four senses. Now, if and when the fifth sense, the sense of sight, could come, if that could have come into operation, then none of them would have said the things that they did say. They would have said something very different in describing that elephant, wouldn't they? So that their perception, which is born of just the use of a certain number of senses, is a misperception in actuality. It is no perception of reality as such. Now the senses that we use, the five senses that we use, we take for granted are all the senses that are available, and therefore whatsoever is conveyed to us through them is the truth of the matter. When the senses, which are the doorways of sense impressions, when the senses receive these impressions, they go to the brain, and the brain does the work of synthesizing the sense impressions and forming concepts about them. It forms pictures about them and so forth, and attaches words of the language to what the sense impressions have conveyed to them. So then they say, this is the truth. But we see that those sense impressions are just by themselves inefficient in themselves and incapable of conveying the total reality of what is experienced. Only a part of that reality gets conveyed through the use of the senses. And we make the mistake of thinking this is the whole reality. One of the proofs in actual fact of the truth of this statement is just this. Take science itself, what we call objective science. If objective science were capable of giving us the whole truth of anything, there could be no development on that, and we would never need to change our ideas. But we know from the history of science that as science progresses, as we call it, we have different conceptions of the nature of the same thing and the qualities and properties and behavior of the same substance or whatever it is. You see, the fact that there is this kind of change, development as we call it, or progress in science through change, and change which in some respects contradicts the old statement, shows that what we have perceived and believed to be quite true is not a true perception. It is, as Mahayana would put it, a no perception. You see? Now there comes the point when we transcend all our limitations, the finite, the mortal, and the temporal, which is ourself, the existential being, in consciousness can completely transcend the limitations imposed by our finitude, temporality, and mortality. We can transcend all those. And there comes that stage and that state of awareness, which is the true ultimate meditative state, in which one is conscious in terms of the totality, the all. That is to say, be careful here. It's very easy to mistake this. One thinks of being conscious of the totality in as if one were conscious of the countless multitudinous things that add up to making a universe. It's not in that sense. When you are conscious of totality, the power that has grown out of you is the power to be able to see the whole truth of any one thing or one person as you observe that person or thing. And in that whole observation of the one thing, you also are aware, in a very extraordinary manner, you are aware of the whole truth of the totality. The totality is embodied in the one, and the one embodies the totality. And they convey, if you could be conscious in terms of the galaxy, you could be equally conscious in terms of any one thing in that galaxy. And any one thing will tell you all about the galaxy itself. That is the peculiarity of the nature of consciousness. When consciousness comes to its full fruition, then that is what happens. Now in the Upanishads, for instance, it is stated quite openly that Brahman, Atma and consciousness, absolute consciousness, are an identity. It's very interesting. They are an identity. They are one and the same fact, one and the same reality. The Upanishadic teachers and the Hindus use the word Atma. The Buddha did not use the word Atma. He used a phrase which is the real equivalent of the Upanishadic Atma. He used the phrase Vijnanam Anidassanam Anantam Sabbato Paham. Vijnana, which is discriminative consciousness, your consciousness and my consciousness as it is functioning at the moment. You see, separating everything. If you didn't use your vijnana and had not developed the capacity for the supreme meditative state, then you would not understand what on earth I was saying. You have to use your discriminative consciousness in order to know what I am trying to put before you, and in order that you may move about and work in the everyday world in the ordinary way. So vijnana is that, this discriminative, separative consciousness. It is characteristic of the misconceived I am I. But this, when this consciousness is completely transcended and has become the absolute consciousness, the all consciousness, which sees truth, the whole truth, immediately and quite naturally, then it is the vijnanam anidassanam, without characteristics. That is to say, it is unconditioned, completely unconditioned, anidassanam, anantam, endless. It has no ending to it. And having no ending, it has no beginning, which means that the whole factor of time is completely out. And not only time is out, but timelessness is also out. And thus, both birth and death are out of that situation. You are functioning in terms of eternity. And mind you, this is not easy. You may say, yes, I understand what you say. That is to say, you will understand the sort of intellectual content of it. But unless you get the real inner thrill, which quite transcends the intellectual content, you won't really know what it is all about. Anantam, therefore, endless, sabbato, everywhere. There are two words which are used, one in the Majjhima Nikaya, one in the Digha Nikaya. Pabham, meaning accessible. Pahang, meaning shining. Shining. Eternal light, as the theistic religions put it. May light perpetual shine upon them. And you see, death in the real sense, death in its proper, if you properly understand death, then you will see that it is the doorway into eternity, the doorway into totality. But it is not eternity and totality for you as you. It is the eternity and immortality of the total reality, of the infinite, eternal, immortal, in which there is no separate I or you involved. You are a river. When you reach the sea and have your water, you, the waters, the river waters, have completely mingled with the ocean, where are you? How are you to be identified? You can't do it. You see, we like to preserve a tiny little bit which will have a comfortable little chair in the front row of the stalls of heaven. See, this is our absurdity. We are extraordinarily stupid that way. We don't realize that infinity, eternity, and immortality completely subsume all this which is finite, temporal, and mortal. So we have our fears, our anxieties, we can be upset. Each time I am upset at anything, or I feel fear in any situation, I ask myself, how now? You've sort of jumped back into the other box, like a cat, you know, which has a favorite box in which it will stay, and it will jump into another box. I've jumped into another box, you see. No, that won't do. So, that we must bear in mind carefully in all that we do. Now, with regard to this question of death, I said that the existential being dies completely. And since the different religions of the world have all talked in terms of a hereafter, a something for you, what you yourself obtain, and so forth. Let me just read to you what the Buddha himself says at the end of the Brahmajala Sutta. The Brahmajala means the perfect net, the divine net. Brahma, jala is a net, the divine net, in which, as the scholars say, the Buddha gives an analysis of the 62 different prevailing systems of philosophy and so forth. And then he says, when he has finished this very long discourse, he says, just, O monks, as when the stalk of a bunch of mangoes has been cut, all the mangoes that were hanging on that stalk go with it. When the stalk is cut, that little bit of the mango tree is dead, dies, doesn't it? And all the mangoes that may have been on the stalk also go with it completely. Now, we talked a bit about how does karma work out. The way I have been trying to present it to you may make you feel that karma cannot work out that way. What about all the thoughts and actions you have done? You must have another life in order to work them out, and so forth. No, not at all. All that was unworked out here, in that sense, as far as the existential being, I myself, am concerned, is dead, completely dead. But the effect of my thought, feeling and so forth has already made its impress on the totality. And the totality in its new expression of new individuals will produce an individual through whom these unworked out effects will work themselves out. And you'll say, oh, but that's not fair. Why should I get off scot-free for all my misdeeds? I ought to be hanged, drawn and quartered 20 times over for the terrible things I've done. No, the universe doesn't work that way. That's the whole point. And if it worked that way, there'd be no possibility of anything like grace or compassion or true wisdom or true goodness or beauty anywhere. You brood over what we have tried to consider together this afternoon. Brood over it. Let the mind be quiet and see if in the real inner quietude of the mind, true insight doesn't emerge. You will find it emerging. And you will also find that through you then, compassion and wisdom will work together in the real sense. They will emerge and affect not only yourself, but your total environment. And it will help to making you a benediction to the world around you. Without your knowing it, naturally and spontaneously it will happen. And there is beauty in that. And that beauty, which is a transcendent beauty, and that compassion and wisdom, which is a transcendent compassion and wisdom, cannot come by any sort of premeditated means or efforts, because our premeditated means and efforts all suffer from the defects of our conditioning and from our very inadequate insight into the reality of things. It is through the agency of death, as we ordinarily understand it, that self-transcending can take place. In the evolutionary process, this is why, this is how death holds a place of such tremendous importance. Without death, there cannot be the self-transcending, and something more wonderful emerges afterwards. And that self-transcending takes place in its perfection only insofar as each one of us is free from the I am I as a separate being misconception. Insofar as we are free from that.